Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I'm looking at an article. This is an editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the title is Universal Masking to Prevent SARS-CoV Transmission, The Time Is Now. Oh, my friends, is it ever? We have the Labor Day three-day weekend coming up. And what I've observed as a keen observer of humanity is that when holidays roll around, whether they are birthdays or shared holidays like Mother's Day, Memorial Day, and the 4th of July, we have a set of stereotypical behaviors. I guess Thanksgiving's probably the most stereotypical of the holidays in that regard, but we have a set of expectations which are deeply held and hard to ignore. So I want to emphasize the importance of adding an additional behavior to your stereotypical set of behaviors and wear a mask for the holiday. If you are outside of your house, have one with you. It is so important. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story about some brave Americans who literally are dying for their freedom. And this first death, which was just reported, is a man from Minnesota. He's the first person to have died after catching COVID at the Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota last month. That was about 3 weeks ago. He's dying right on schedule. And this was a 10-day event where many of freedom-minded Americans met, and they were not going to do any social distancing or wear masks. And unfortunately, that kind of backfired on him. So we have something on the order of 300 known cases, but it's obviously more than that. 300 known cases in people who attended the motorcycle rally. Minnesota has more than 50 of those cases, all tracked back to people who went to Sturgis for the motorcycle rally. Sturgis itself is in Meade County, and before August 1st, they'd had 71 cases in 6 months. In 1 month, that figure had shot up to 305. And that includes 26 in the city of Sturgis, where 650 people took part among the residents at that rally. South Dakota as a whole has more than 2,000 cases in the past week. This is a new record. I believe it's a national record for new cases certainly in South Dakota, but it may be a record for most of the country. I'm really not sure about this. But you see my point. There's a study that just came out, and that was in that issue, August 18th, 2020, that was looking at a healthcare system in Massachusetts. And what they did was they looked to a pre and a post in Massachusetts, March 2020, new infections in healthcare workers with either direct or indirect patient contact before and after the institution of universal masking at the medical facility. So the number of cases among healthcare workers was increasing by about 1% a day. That's a very, very fast increase in the first 2 or 3 weeks of March. About a week after the universal masking policy had been in operation, and by the way, we now know that people are at their maximum risk of transmitting the disease for about a week after they get it, whether they're symptomatic or not. So that's when they saw the inflection and the rates among healthcare workers started to decline. So basically, at the time that people put on masks, everybody who'd been exposed was shedding virus. Once they put the masks on, the shedding of virus stopped, and a week later, you started to see the cases going down. So let me put it this way. you need to have your appendix out. And a team of the surgeon and the anesthesiologist and the scrub nurse and the assistant surgeon come to you and say, we're freedom-loving Americans, and we really don't want to wear a mask while we open up your belly and take out your appendix. As another freedom-loving American, would it be all right with you if we didn't wear masks, you know, just to prove a point? What are your bets that the person who's going to have their appendectomy is going to be that freedom-loving? The data is clear. Cloth, even cloth face coverings, substantially limit the forward dispersion of exhaled respiratory particles, those in the 1 to 10 micron range. These include droplets. Droplets are probably the big issue, which means that these cloth fat mask coverings, as long as they're dry, probably work fairly well. It's a different situation if you're in a patient room that has high concentrations of virus and you're a care provider, particularly if you're going to be the anesthesiologist intubating that patient. In that case, you want a respirator and a face shield and all the isolation you can get, because they're going to be gagging in your face as you intubate them, and you're going to be exposed, if they're positive, to a large dose. When individuals are physically close together and their social distancing is not possible, wearing a mask in a public place makes a huge difference. I will point out what we haven't seen. And what we haven't seen is a huge surge in people who have gone to the demonstrations. We aren't seeing an epidemic in those individuals because most of them were wearing masks. Go look at the images and you'll see what I mean. Not the filmed images where people are mugging for the camera, but the number of people who are marching and carrying signs, and the very, very high percentage of people that I see wearing masks. Guess what? It worked. We have another natural experiment. So please think about this weekend. Think hard and pay close attention. Make sure you have a mask with you and, you know, keep looking around. I planned, if I do go out this weekend, to take a bunch of masks with me and hand them out. Thanks to the state of California, I have enough surgical masks to last me for a while. And I believe that Governor Newsom and the president of the CMA, Peter Breton, who together managed to get these masks distributed to all the primary care doctors in California, and I thank you, would smile on the redistribution of surgical masks to the population. You know what those are selling for down in downtown Watsonville? $1.50 a mask. Well, personal protection for a family of four or five living in one of the communal households, that's taking a serious chunk out of the food budget. So that's just a commentary on how unequal the burden of this disease is when it falls to people in the lower income brackets who can't socially distance in their homes. Well, we're in the age of big data, and big data has come up with some really, really interesting information. So I first need to give you the backstory. Let me pull that up. There it is. This was a group of people who decided to, how should we say this, data mine some material that they had lying around at their institution. So they had bronchial lavage samples from COVID-19, and these were being used to sequence the virus. But of course, they kept them. And then later on, they thought, you know, I wonder if we could find something interesting chemically in here that might give us some additional information about what's going on with COVID. And so they pulled those samples and they ran a bunch of chemistry tests on them. And they found a very, very substantial variation from other forms of sepsis and other forms of shock lung or adult respiratory distress syndrome that may be really key to understanding this very strange bug. So first of all, they discovered that in the chemistry, there were increases in renin, angiotensin, receptors for some of the renin angiotensin system chemicals, increased levels of calicin enzymes that kininogen, which turns into bradykinin, which is a type of inflammatory mediator, and more bradykinin receptors. So this is really interesting because in the non-infected lung, or the lung that's infected with, say, pneumonia that gets ARDS, you don't see increased amounts of ACE2. But ACE2 is, or rather the ACE2 receptor is the thing that the COVID virus hooks onto. So to see those go up is super interesting. But it was complicated. So they plugged it into a supercomputer and let the supercomputer play with the data. And it was, what came out was, you know, look at bradykinin, and a whole bunch of things that bradykinin do turn out to be probably very mission critical in this story. It's a hypothesis, and it's generated by a computer. The lab is Jacobson. The paper was published in something called eCell. But the computer came up with this hypothesis. And then if you start checking it, this thing, bradykinin, well, what COVID appears to do is not just infect cells that naturally have a lot of ACE2 receptors, like the cells of the nose and the gut and the heart, but also trick places that don't have high levels of ACE2 receptors. They're found at low, medium levels in the lung, except after this virus infects you. It actively hijacks the system, and it tweaks this renin-angiotensin system, and it causes the body to make tons of bradykinin. In fact, it doesn't degrade bradykinin because the virus has taken away the enzyme, angiotensin converting enzyme, that normally degrades it. So you have high levels of an inflammatory marker. This is what really fascinates me. The chief thing it does when you have an injury and it's released is it causes swelling. It's the fundamental thing that causes hives. Well, the blood vessels actually start to leak. And as the blood vessels start to leak, the lungs fill with fluid. This isn't an ischemic injury like in shock lung, but the lungs fill with fluid. This is fine, except that the virus also drastically increases the production of hyaluronic acid in the lungs. And when you add water and hyaluronic acid, you get a gel. This compound, which is found, among other things, in your joints, is gooey, and it can absorb more than 100 times its weight in fluid. It's actually used in cosmetics as an injectable into wrinkles because it fills in the wrinkles from below. That hydrogel can fill the air sacs in the lungs. And according to one of the researchers, in a phrase that I thought was just brilliant, it's like trying to breathe through jello, which could explain why ventilators don't work as well as they should, because what looks like shock lung on the x-ray, which looks like ARDS, isn't fluid in the lungs. It's goo, and you can't squeeze the goo back out of the lungs into the circulation the way that you could if it was just fluid. So this explains one of the mysteries of how people can suffocate even when they're on high-dose ventilation. That shouldn't be happening, but it sure is. Well, the heart, bradykinin in the heart, it causes arrhythmias and low blood pressures, exactly what we see in the COVID-19 patients and the neurological symptoms. Bradykinin causes damage to the blood-brain barrier. This causes people to have leaky blood vessels in their brains, and their brains swell and they get seizures, which also is highly reported. People have neurological problems at a much, much greater rate than you typically see. And these could be directly related to the loss of the blood-brain barrier. The other thing that COVID-19 may be doing is it's causing the dry cough, right? We know that. Well, ACE inhibitors, drugs like captopril and lisinopril, which you may be familiar with, their major limiting factor is that about a 25% of the population gets a dry cough, and we have to stop and pivot to a different drug. Same mechanism. ACE inhibitors also cause a loss of taste and smell. And bradykinin causes vascular leaking. This could be why you see those COVID toes, which are essentially like chilblains, which is a cold-induced, frostbite-induced capillary leakage. Well, this is a chemically induced capillary leakage as part of the cascade of events which are responsible for this. Now, the good news, and the reason this story is important, this is theoretical. It is a hypothetical thing based on observations. It's damn internally consistent, but it's not proven. However, there are drugs that reduce bradykinin production, and there are blockers of the bradykinin receptor. One in particular looks really promising. It's called icatibant. It has a trade name. I'm going to give you the trade name. F-I-R-A-Z-Y-R is FDA approved for the treatment of hereditary angioedema, which is a rare hereditary condition triggered by, basically a overactive receptor to bradykinin. Guess what? Vitamin D inhibits all of this. It's involved in the RAS system, and it reduces the bradykinin storms from forming. This has been known. It's actually been reported that people who have higher levels of vitamin D are less likely to get sick. I think I gave you that story a little while ago. It's available over the counter, and anyone who has a vitamin D level of less than 30, the science says start powering down the vitamin D. A dose of 4,000 or 5,000 a day is safe, according to the Institute of Medicine, a notoriously conservative body. And if you've got a low level, you probably need to get that level up, because unfortunately, I don't think even if everybody in the country started wearing masks immediately and doing social distancing, there's still the potential for being exposed. And we need to get this information out there. We need to get studies going on this Firazyr and the other agents that reduce bradykinin production and see if we can show that anything is going to help. Very excited about this information. And I must say, I kind of love the big data piece where you just essentially do a search, you know, this and this and this and this, and feed it all the medical literature on COVID and let it chuck along for a while and come up with, let's look at bradykinin. Okay, let's look at bradykinin. Okay, we're going to go to emails now. And we have an on-air email from Elizabeth. I have been considering an air purifier, and there's an interesting type which uses incineration rather than a HEPA. I did a lot of research, and it's quite valid for many uses. However, the specs say it clears dust mites, not dust. I don't know what that means. Do you use some? She's talking about the air-free Onyx 3000 air sterilizer kills 99.99% of airborne microorganisms. Let's remember that COVID is not a microorganism, as we would traditionally. It's not a virus and it's not a mold. It basically heats up air to 400, sterilizing it and eliminating harmful ozone, fungus, bacteria, allergens, viruses, mold, dust, and more, and then brings the air back down to you. Doesn't need maintenance or filters. Great option for someone who wants to preserve works of art that could be harmed by mold and mildew, blah, 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 blah. Okay. So I'm still happier with HEPA filters because they have some actual data. I like the idea of pulling. I would suggest looking at an air filter that uses ultraviolet radiation. And while I think it's heating, if it heats up the air to 400 and sterilizes it, my question is, how much air does it heat? How quickly does it cool it down? And what's the refresh rate in the room? Because that cooling it down, I just am not sure it's going to work quickly enough. It's a great thing to like leave going in your bedroom, and I think it would be very effective for people with allergies. But I'm not sure that it's as good as what we're using in the medical offices or the dental offices, most of the ones I've been in anyway, which is a filter with UV. So it goes through the HEPA filter. You get let's call it 95% of the little particles, most all of the droplets, but there's still going to be some small particles that have accumulated in the room. And we think that can be a problem in high concentration. And it's all about the refresh rate. And unfortunately, your email doesn't give me that. But my recommendation would be spend the money. You're probably looking at $200 for a HEPA plus ultraviolet. And the data on ultraviolet is just solid for killing this virus. So I hope that that answers Elizabeth's question. Our next email is from Karen in Santa Barbara. Karen is a podcast listener and used the AskDrDawn.com contact us to talk to us about this. Karen writes, repeat shot. My 89-year-old mother and had her flu vaccine on August 19th, 2020, the high-dose version. Her health status includes a non-contagious lung infection, Mycobacterium avium complex, also called non-tuberculous mycobacterium. This is only contagious if you are immunosuppressed. For example, it's a common infection in HIV. That's my parenthetic comment about her calling it non-contagious. Not to someone with an intact immune system is it contagious. She also has AFib all the time. Her two main care helpers, children, also had flu shots in August. She follows good practices to reduce coronavirus exposure. Her greatest exposure is when visiting doctor's offices in person, masked, up to four times a month when telehealth isn't appropriate. We had flu shots unusually early this year due to COVID. Would it be advisable for mom and or us kids to have a second round late season? If yes, what timeline would you recommend, please? If no, then is there an argument to get vaccinated on this early timeline, even in future non-pandemic years? The advice that I have given, it's science-based advice based on studies that came out around 2007 and 2008, was the sweet spot is late September, early October, because your immunity is going to wane in April, and by then we're pretty much out of the woods. A recent article, this was done in 2016, in the Journal of Infectious Disease, Volume 14, Issue 8, October 15th, 2016, showed that, and I've got a chart up here. So this is a chart from that article, and it's very good because it shows a placebo group in terms of weekly incidence of influenza in a community. And it looks at vaccinate people who were vaccinated at T equals zero, which would have been, looks like December was when they start this cohort. And basically the flu season hits. The placebo group by early January is starting to have influenza. The vaccinated group is not. What they see is a waning of immunity such that the vaccinated group crosses placebo in early to mid-February. So my recommendation, because it's the curve is really clear, the immunity starts to wane in early February. So since you got your shot in August, did you say? And most of these people got their shots in October. You're going to subtract two, which puts you in early February. So I would recommend that your mother and her caregivers boost in February, and that's based on science, but it's also based on group-sourced science, and it's conservative, because I'd rather have your mother have a sore arm than a case of influenza during a COVID epidemic, particularly since she has immunocompromised lungs. We have another on-air message from Gary. I have a kidney stone in my duct between my kidney and bladder. I'm having it removed this Tuesday, looking for a preventative diet in the future. Well, Gary, the first thing you need to do is ask them what kind of stone it is. The more common ones would be uric acid stones and calcium carbonate stones. And for those, while there is a diet for uric acid stones, which I will tell you about, the more common thing is going to be to drink lots and lots of fluid. keep it at the 2 liters a day. Staying hydrated is the real key thing for preventing recurrent stones. Now, I mentioned uric acid stones. If it's a uric acid stone, you need to cut back on your vitamin C. I once had a drug-seeking patient a long time ago, but I never forgot this. He had uric acid stones, and he would use that. He would basically give himself a kidney stone so that he could get a prescription for narcotics. And he also learned how to fake kidney stones, which information I am not going to share. But the most important question really here is, what is the stone? And when you know that, I'd be happy to give you a specific preventative diet. A lot of times it will be similar to the diet that we use for gout, but not always. So let's hear from you when we know what kind of stone it is, and we'll pick up the information. This is pinging a little bit on what I was saying about the vascular, the blood clots, the effects of COVID. And we had a wonderful interview with Dr. Howard Kornfeld in May about the MATH Plus protocol, which included steroids, high-dose vitamin C, thiamine, and heparin, a blood thinner. This latest observational study took a look back at people who had received at Mount Sinai Hospital, whether they had received an anticoagulation regimen or not, and they found a substantial shift in the chance of survival. Specifically, patients on a therapeutic dose and also those on a prophylactic dose had about a 50% higher chance of survival and a 30% lower chance of intubation. So the idea that bradykinin is causing some of this leakage, and also the upregulation of hyaluronic acid that I spoke about earlier, and the idea that it's just blood clots causing blood not to flow to parts of the lung, and therefore the air sacs are not getting perfused. This is called a VQ shunt, which stands for ventilation perfusion, Q being the what shall we say, the number or letter that's used algebraically to convey the concept of lung perfusion. So the VQ shunt is what they look like, and that's an unusual thing to be seeing. You could help it by giving blood clotting inhibition agents, and one of the ones on the MATH Plus protocol that was used was the heparin. So World Health Organization and another study that came out this week made very big news in the New York Times was the idea that the use of steroids was very helpful to people who were sick, acutely ill with COVID. And that does appear to have been substantiated by increased data. Very important because it's going to affect our behavior as doctors when we see patients. And the other reason this is really important is that these are not rare orphan drugs. We have these in abundance. We have the blood thinners, we have the steroids, and if both of those make such large differences in survival, then it seems to me that the combination of the two, given that they are frequently used together all the time, and therefore we know that they're safe in combination, is a no-brainer and hopefully will become a immediate best practice going forward. Now, this is a little bit worrisome, and that is the recent documents that were given to public health officers in all states and territories, as well as some of the major big cities. And they outlined detailed scenarios for distributing two unnamed vaccine requirement. Each requires 2 doses a few weeks apart, so no hints there. And they wanted the healthcare professionals to be aware of what the priorities were going to be and start thinking about how they were going to pull this off. Long-term healthcare employees would be among the first to receive the product, along with healthcare professionals, essential workers, and national security employees. people over 65, those from racial and ethnic minority populations, Native Americans, incarcerated. You get the idea. It's the usual people who are showing up with very high rates. And the concept is a good one, but I feel that it is early, and it concerns me that they were not willing to announce which of the vaccines that they are asking them to plan for. I also think about having two shots a couple weeks apart and the logistics and the difficulty of doing that. And we all need to start thinking about how to stand aside and let the most vulnerable in our population receive a safe vaccine. But the timing of this late October, cavalry riding to the rescue just in time for the election, seems to be just further politicization. And I want to emphasize this is me expressing an opinion, but it seems like the timing is premature. And I'd love to see data that proves me wrong. But this is not, unfortunately, a highly data-driven situation. This is a preliminary story from a recent issue of JAMA looking at genetic variations. You know, most young people do okay from this. Every now and then, a young male, and it's always a young male, gets very, very sick. So this took a look at pairs of brothers, which is fascinating. Brothers admitted to the intensive care unit. Four men from two unrelated families were admitted to the ICUs. And then they also analyzed the genetics of other available family members. And they did something called a rapid clinical whole exome sequencing, which means they looked at all the DNA. And they found what are called loss of function variants in a gene called TLR7 on the X chromosome in one of the families. And in the second set of families, there was a missense variant, in other words, a typo that affected the production of this particular TLR. What is TLRD? Well, it turns out that it controls interferon signaling. And there was significantly decreased interferon of both upon stimulation with a drug known to stimulate this. So basically, people who had decreased production of a type 2 interferon called interferon gamma, which is known to be anti-inflammatory,
were less able to modulate inflammation. Everything we know about how COVID kills you, the diabetes, the obesity, even this obscure genetic variation teaches us the same thing. It's the inflammation. All of these diverse factors
all eventually converge on this pivot point of, can you turn down inflammation? How good are you at turning down inflammation? And that is a question that we all need to think for ourselves and answer. Ask your doctor what's going on. One last coronavirus story, I promise. But the numbers kind of blew me away here. India is in the middle of a very severe lockdown. They have high infection rates and a lot of gig workers in India who are not making any money at all. Their children often get a lot of their nutrition from school lunch programs. And with shutdown, 115 million children are at risk for malnutrition, protein malnutrition, not just vitamin deficiencies, but actual protein malnutrition, which seriously compromises the ability to fight off infectious diseases. In fact, 1 million children under five die in India every year, and the cause of death in 7 out of 10 of them is attributed to malnutrition. This is a huge blow for that lifeline sustaining those families. And even going out and bringing food to the families isn't going to necessarily work because if you're a family and you're poor, you're going to share that food and probably not give that growing child as much as they need. It's very, very sad. Let's move on to something. How about if I say something positive about the FDA and the NIH? How about that? It's certainly been the subject of a lot of criticism lately, but the NIH has actually begun what I and all of my functional medicine colleagues are very interested to see, which is a catalyst for modernizing nutrition research. It's called the Strategic Plan for NIH Nutrition, and they're going to start looking at precision nutrition. Let me give you an example of precision nutrition. Regular listeners on the show may have heard of the MTHFR mutation. It's present in about 3% of the population at large. Some unlucky individuals will have
two bad copies of this gene that codes for the enzyme that converts
folic acid into activated folate, which is a cofactor in an amazing array of important biological processes. And this would include increased risks of heart disease, increased risks of cancer, increased risks of depression, and I could go on. This folic acid is involved in the prevention of birth defects, and people with this mutation have a much higher risk of having children with birth defects, particularly oral facial abnormalities, unless they, and not fun, spina bifida, and the being born like those poor children who are infected with Zika in South America with either microbrains or holes in their, literally holes in their head that prevent the formation of a normal brain. This is the type of thing that a personalized nutrition program with a battery of tests that are done once in your life, probably at birth, to determine if you have any of these unique vulnerabilities and therefore require a slightly different form of a vitamin. It's only with big data and personalized genetics that we're going to be able to tease out these variant human beings. Our science is a blunt instrument when it comes to studying things like this. We can look at the herd. We can do medicine, really good medicine and outcome data for the average. But just like these young men and COVID, there are people who are just walking around looking just fine, who are not average and have unique vulnerabilities that much of the time can actually be treated with nutritional therapy. And it needs to happen. It needs to be a priority. And I'm so happy to see the government in the form of the NIH actually acknowledging that and beginning to do some work on it. Some of the other things they're going to do is look at microbiome information, looking to fine-tune the appropriate diet. You know, this eat for your blood type thing, I've never believed in that. But I do believe that eating to shape and amend your microbiome is a completely legitimate thing to be doing. And I can't wait to see some serious funding being thrown at this, at the nutrition piece of it, because much of the microbiome research is not being done with the idea that we can manipulate the nutrition to help the health of the individual. But I believe that to be very, very true, and I'm excited about this new work. It's a 10-year plan. It's ambitious. It's actually funded. And I believe that it will have the effect of causing nutrition to be resurrected as a topic of importance to doctors. And it hasn't been a topic that's been well taught or emphasized to in medical science since the invention of antibiotics and the growth of the pharmaceutical industry. So I'm really happy to see that happening. Another microbiome story is researchers at the University of Illinois in Chicago looking at, can you shift the microbiome and how does it shift if you simply mess up sleep? This is a study. So let's emphasize that the microbiome of rat, while complex, is not identical to that of humans. So this needs to be validated in humans. But the people who decided to do the research are people who worked night shift for a long time as emergency room physicians and then moved over to research. So they always wondered, once they started looking at the microbiome, whether or not their lifestyle as a shift worker had an effect on it. And so they've created an animal model here. They took telemetry transmitters that measured the rat's brain activity, blood pressure, and heart rate. They also collected stool and analyzed changes in the microbial content. And when they basically woke the rats up during their normal sleep period, the first thing that they saw was an increase in blood pressure. That was the first change they saw in the rats. And it lasted for quite a while after they let them go back to normal sleeping. So this dysfunctional sleep had a prolonged effect on blood pressure. I've already been emphasizing sleep quite a bit in my practice, but I think I need to, when I'm having trouble understanding why I can't get someone's blood pressure down, I need to do a sleep survey and see if they have modifiable habits that we might be able to leverage. The microbiome changed more slowly. It took about a week to show unfavorable responses, chiefly an increase in pro-inflammatory bacteria without there being a dietary change. Now, I always thought that the connection between inflammation and sleep deprivation had to do with the fact in these observational studies that people eat differently when they're sleep deprived. They tend to eat more and possibly more coffee or more sugared beverages like cola drinks to stay alert. And so I thought it was probably a direct dietary thing. But no, actually, even when the diet is held standard, the microbiome alteration occurs. We need to look at this in humans, and we need to really start looking at shift work and blood pressure connection in individuals as they age. We know that there's an increased risk of cancer. That's thought to be due to the inhibitory effects of inflammation, but maybe that's just a third variable. Maybe it's really about these shifts in the microbiome. So the question is, can we gut garden this microbiome back into better shape in individuals? Firefighters come to mind. I would do anything I could to improve the health of firefighters right now. We all owe them an enormous debt of gratitude in California for their sacrifice and heroism. So I would love to start thinking about how we can help shift workers, because some of it's going to be undeniable. Power plant workers, you know, we've got to have shift workers. How can we do this in a way that's healthier for them so that their sacrifice is not any bigger than it has to be? This next story harks back to something that we've talked about in the past, but I'm going to review it. This is the finding that after, in the case of the early studies, 10 years on the osteoporosis drugs of the class bisphosphonate, atypical mid-shaft femur fractures started to occur. This is not a place where this bone breaks. Due to its mechanical properties, the femur has vulnerable areas up at the top in the hip area. But the only way that you get a mid-shaft femur fracture is if a truck runs into your femur at 30 miles an hour. It's not the direction the bone usually breaks or the place it usually breaks. But about 10 years ago, we started to see reports of an increasing number of these atypical fractures, and a little bit of work and correlation led to the discovery that these were occurring in people who had been on the bisphosphonates for a long time. It led to a change in how we dose these things, because we typically will stop after 5 years and give people a drug break for a year or two and actually let them lose a little bit of bone from their spine and from the vulnerable part of the hip, so that the places that aren't getting rebuilt properly are able to be addressed by the body and re-strengthened. The bisphosphonates essentially work by slowing down the breakdown of bone. But the breakdown of bone is a fundamental part of how we keep bone healthy. So over time, the bones that are not allowed to be broken down and rebuilt, because unfortunately the rebuilding has slowed down and the breakdown hasn't, those areas of bone change and their mechanical properties change. And this thinning of the cortex of the femur is why people were starting to get mid-thigh fractures. This latest study tried to figure out the risk. It was a study done out of Kaiser. They have a lot of data. They went through everyone in their database for 10 years in the Southern California healthcare system called Kaiser Permanente Southern California, and they modeled a risk-benefit ratio. They also teased out something I thought was extremely interesting and hadn't heard before, a racial difference between the fracture risk in Asian women versus Caucasian women. But the risk ratios for this type of fracture were substantial. After more than 5 years of use, the risk ratio, let's see, it was, yeah, if you were at 5 years of use, you were 400% more likely to have a mid-shaft femur fracture. But they also looked at, well, what was the risk of having a hip fracture and how much over these years did that get benefited while the mid-shaft femur fractures went up? In 3 years, treating 1,929 women. In that very large number, they had 277 atypical femur fractures occur. They also had many times that, probably, there's not a number here in the summary, but it would have been on the order of somewhere around 20,000 women get a typical femur fracture or a osteoporosis-related hip fracture. So you, over 3 years, they had 149 hip fractures prevented and two atypicals, whereas in Asians, the atypical fractures were much more common. And this probably relates to the fact that the bones in Asian women, particularly in this age group, because we're talking boomers here, is smaller. Well, we've come to the end of the hour.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.